Thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Mornings podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here as I'm getting my coffee organized and my paper and my Bible open. And it's open to Psalm 19, which I am reading. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. And boy, do we have some skies today all across the listenership. Looks to be like a near perfect day. In verse 7, it says, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. And then these words, which I'm trying to apply to myself today. In 14, it says, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. So I certainly hope the words of my mouth are wise and simple today and encouraging to you, because you've got a day that I don't know what's going on in your day, but I know you've got a lot on your schedule. And maybe there's something that's especially something that's making you nervous. So I just want to let you know that you are going to be loved and prayed for by God and by us here at the station. We are always thinking about our listeners, and we want you to have a place to come every morning where you can feel encouraged. You can feel lifted up by God's word and encouraged by what you hear on the station. And then also, we're going to try to give you as much as we can with news and top-of-the-mind stories, and then other ways to build up the body of Christ. So that's the big agenda here today. We've got a great schedule. You know, I'm looking on history, and today in history, big day for states joining the Union. 1792, Kentucky joined. And in 1796, Tennessee joined. And this was very disturbing to me. In 1944, the government of Mexico abolished the siesta. How dare they? Because most days, I always say I'm about two naps away from a perfect day. And in 1980, CNN made its debut. Hard to believe, in 1980. Doesn't seem like it's been around forever. Anyway, we have Dr. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College. He's going to come up, and we're going to talk about much of what's been going on with the president. He's had quite the international week with all of his travel. We're going to process a little of that and other top items in the news. So it's 6 minutes after Adam is on the line. We'll take a short break and connect you to Dr. Adam Carrington in just a minute. All right, good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Dr. Adam Carrington is a professor at Hillsdale College, professor of politics, among other things. A new dad, we're still excited about that. And he is on our studio line. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. So after this international travel for the president, most of our heads are getting ready to explode.
Yes.
I mean, he was warmly welcomed in Saudi Arabia, and he did pretty good in Israel, and then he went and then got snubbed by the European allies about NATO.
That's really fascinating that Saudi Arabia, who I think I mentioned the last time we talked, he actually had called out for 9/11, since so many of the terrorists that hijacked the planes back in 2001 were Saudi Arabian, and received a very warm welcome. I think that was just the position that Saudi Arabia wanted to take regarding him, to say that he's been rough with them and they want to keep those diplomatic channels open. And at the same time, you said Europe, it was basically a snub. It was watching the pictures were worth a lot for without even reading what was said. When President Trump was calling out NATO allies, saying that they weren't contributing their fair share to mutual defense, it looked like most of the leaders watching had eaten something that disagreed with him, and including too his that picture that's gone around a lot where when he met with the Pope Francis, and you have that picture of the of President Trump smiling, and it looks like Pope Francis was just told that his best friend had passed away. Mm-hmm. So you really, even in the picture, saw a lot of the tension and a lot of a little bit of what relations might be going forward with Europe, which is a lot more contentious, more, at least a little more contentious and less cooperative maybe than in the past.
Mm-hmm. Adam, what are some of the facts of the U.S. and the relationship they have with NATO? We've always pulled our weight, and we've been critical of nations that haven't, and Trump's finally standing up and saying, hey, fork it over.
Yeah, and one thing to understand the logistics of is it's not that there's this common pot of money or this common military force that is NATO. NATO was put together, though, originally as a way to defend Western Europe against a possible encroachment by the Soviet Union, and has since become sort of a way to maintain unity and peace within Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but what it means is each country is supposed to pull, as you say, a certain amount of weight, and as President Trump has said. And a lot of the countries in Europe, now there are exceptions in Eastern Europe and the United Kingdom, but other countries are not building up their own militaries to the degree that they have been supposed to. And even to the degree that any of the increases that have recently happened were actually negotiated under President Obama in 2014, where he was trying to get them to do a similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but many of them are leaning and have leaned since World War II very, very heavily on the United States as the country with the largest and strongest military, and has therefore been able to, as President Trump has pointed out, devote more of their economy to doing domestic things that I think President Trump says he would like to do here in the United States.
So really, for a lot of countries, it's obviously there's economic concerns that prohibits them from participating in NATO in ways that the United States would like them to.
Yes, economic, but some of it, you know, there's certainly countries that are hard-pressed, especially in Eastern Europe, but some of these countries, such as France and Germany, their economies are fine, at least as far as, you know, factors beyond their control. It really is that they have made a priority of having a more generous welfare state, having commitments to spend their money on infrastructure, other things that they believe they can do because the United States has sort of been the enforcer of peace throughout Europe and the world. And I think something that President Trump is saying, and we'll see how much, you know, is able to be forced to be done, but he is trying to say that America is going to be moderating that role, and that if it's going to moderate that role, it's going to demand that its allies step up their game as well. So I don't think that it's as if these countries are in dire, you know, financial shape. They really have just made choices based on the idea that they think they would be protected by the United States.
Mm-hmm. Adam, you're the perfect combo mix because you're you know, political professor, but you also come from a Christian worldview. So when you're looking at President's first foreign tour, what impressions or messages did you walk away with that you felt good about?
Well, I would say that he was actually a little more tempered, and even when he was criticizing NATO, a little more tempered. And I think that something we should hope for our leaders is someone who can work with others, someone who can recognize the humanity in others, and I think that you saw that more than maybe some people were worried about. At the same time, you certainly want firmness. You know, I think that if you look at you were saying from a Christian perspective, if you look at the way kings are good and bad kings are and rulers are portrayed in the Bible, they're called upon to look out for the good of the people God has given them rule over.
Mm-hmm.
That he has given them the task to serve first and foremost. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't recognize the humanity of others, that you shouldn't seek to help others. But I think that he certainly was trying to at least push attempts to help America not bear as much of a burden in the world. So those are things I think are positive. Now, I will have to see going forward with the NATO commitments. I think sometimes he's talked a little too flippantly about NATO, as if he was ready to pull out of it, as if he was ready to ditch it. And I think that he's going to have to walk a fine line, because at some point, if you play that game of chicken, you're going to have your allies just say, well, we're not going to contribute any money if we don't think you're going to stick around. How can he balance that idea of saying, we need you to play your part, but at the same time, we're still here and going to be committed as long as other people play by the rules?
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things, I guess, both on as just thinking from the political science perspective and from the Christian perspective. There are very important necessities of understanding really what is in the common good of the people over which God has given you the task to rule. And I think, you know, there's signs both ways for President Trump, but I think this foreign trip showed some promise on that front.
Adam, I'm going to take a little break, but when I come back, I want to ask you about the resignation of the White House Communications Director, Mike Dubke, and then also the way they're looking into Jared Kushner and the episode with the Russians and this backdoor communications channel, which I think is kind of standard practice in politics, but I'll find out from you in a minute. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us. We'll be right back. Good morning. It's 18 minutes after the hour. Hope your day's starting well. Pour another cup of coffee, sit back, and relax as I'm talking to Dr. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College. We're talking about, I'm going to ask him now, Adam, about Mike Dubke, the White House Communications Director, resigns after 3 months, and at the point of his resignation, I think was the first time I'd heard his name.
Yes, and that's where, really, this is where sort of the spin machines go into full mode on both sides, because when you don't have a lot of information and the person wasn't extremely public and on record, then, you know, there's a lot that can be read into what happened. And it is interesting. I mean, for someone to leave an administration after 3 months is a pretty short stint.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know all the details about why. He said it was personal, so there could be family reasons. There could be, you know, the White House is a grueling place to work under any administration.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you do have to wonder how much of this can at least be perceived as the difficulties that the Trump administration has had at times with organizing and putting forward a consistent message and taking on a very hostile media, but one that they had to know coming in was going to be so. Is this a reflection that he either himself or others didn't think that he was able to do what is a very important job for a president who has had a lot of his success by finding ways to communicate with the people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine it would be a very difficult job, and you're a new dad, so I think that job, they say, roughly takes up 16 hours a day of your time. I don't think you would want that job, even though you would be initially attracted to the idea of it. You would then realize, boy, I never see my family anymore.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll say, actually, I did some campaign work at one point when I was younger and, you know, saw the lifestyle and actually enjoyed it, but at the same time said, that kind of lifestyle is so difficult to have a family. It's so difficult to maintain friendships, to have a certain stability in your family that isn't just making your job your life. So it wouldn't surprise me if that actually was taken into account. Although 3 months in, at the same time, that's something you should know and be told up front.
Yeah.
I interviewed for a White House internship once when I was in college, and they just told me up front, as an intern, you're going to be working all the time, every day, the entire time you're here. So,
mm-hmm.
So it could be, but at the same time, it also was something that I think is should be known ahead of time.
Yeah. All right. Adam, I'm interested in your take on the relationship that Jared Kushner is having with Russia, and apparently the Russian ambassador and Jared, discussed the possibility of setting up a secret and sort of secure communications for the teams, using diplomatic facilities in a way to have a back channel, so to speak, where apparently a lot of administrations have done this. True, false?
Yeah, and
Jared's denying it.
And there is denials that this was even set up, but you're right that there is a long history of setting up these sort of, you know, back channels by, and what's meant by that is going around the normal diplomatic procedure, sometimes leaving the State Department out of the loop, sometimes leaving the normal communicators out of the loop, sometimes even communicating through indirect persons. You know, almost playing a little game of telephone. You
mm-hmm.
have one person talk to another person, and both of them are sort of unofficially speaking for the president and the other foreign dignitary. There is a history of it. This happened in World War II between FDR and the Soviets. It has happened in the Obama administration. It happened in the Nixon administration. It happened in the Kennedy administration in various ways. So having back-channel communications is not strange. And I think that the push to make this look like something illegal, something out of, you know, something that is out of the ordinary for administrations is a stretch. I think the only thing that holds at least some water is, I think, since Kushner has had such a amorphous and very broad role in the White House, would it have been wiser to have had this handled by someone with a little more diplomatic experience, someone with a little more of an understanding of the particular issues related to the U.S. and Russia? Could there have been someone that the president trusted to do that? But that's a question of how wise was this to do, not whether things like this have been done in the past or not.
Mm-hmm. Adam, I want to shift a little bit to the taxes that the government collects. I found this interesting, and from a historical perspective, maybe you can weigh in on this. In 1961, when Kennedy was elected, the federal government collected $94 billion in taxes, and I think last year we were at $3.26 trillion in taxes we collected. And all this time, President Kennedy was arguing for lower taxes. What exactly is going on?
And actually got them. was one of the last Democrats to push for and get significant tax relief. Well, I guess Bill Clinton did under duress from a Republican Congress. I think what you've seen happen is a shift in understanding. I think it's been both on the part of the American people, but even in a beyond what they want in places like Washington, D.C., where the question is, what do we want government to do? What are the ends of government? And if you go back to something like the Declaration of Independence, it's a pretty short but very important list: protect the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And there's, of course, a lot of things under those categories, but that's a fairly limited. It's not whatever the people want. It's not whatever bureaucrats want. Its government is established for these limited ends, and the rest of your life as a member of a church, as a member of a family, as a member of a community is left to your liberty. And I think that we've seen a shift in that. We've seen a shift where more and more the government is of its own initiative, without mm-hmm. the people's consent, taking on more, and people, you know, some people are pushing more and more for the government to do more, and I think that what they want is often security, and what bureaucrats often want is power. But I think the result of that is a question of, what does that do to our liberty? What does that do to us as beings that have lives beyond politics, lives beyond just our citizenship?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting, Adam. I so appreciate that we've made such a jump in the way in which the government has collected taxes. It's hard to figure out where everything's going. We're certainly wasting a lot of money. $94 billion in 1961 is a lot of money, although I think that was my college pizza budget back then. But anyway, it's always nice to get your perspective, and I always appreciate you coming on the show.
I love to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Adam. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. It is 27 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and be right back. Good morning. It's half past the hour. Bill Arnold here. In just a minute after the news, we're going to talk to Dr. Cal Beisner. President Trump says that he's making a decision today on whether or not he'll stay in the Paris Climate Agreement. And Dr. Beisner will help us understand that and process that. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute. Good morning. It's 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Do you feel abandoned by God today? I don't want you to feel that way. But if you do, Pastor Peter Haas points to Psalm 34:7, one of the many times God's promises that he loves us and will never leave us.
We don't always feel like God cares, but I want to just encourage people that, listen, no matter what you're going through today, whether you feel like God is close or near, he loves you so much to have an angel encamping around you. And he commands his angels concerning us. And when I think about that, I keep thinking, why am I freaking out about something little, my schedule, whatever it is? I think we all have these burdens that are just kind of weighing us down. And God's up in heaven saying, oh my gosh, if you had any idea how much I care about you, or even the angel that's encamping, dude, who do you think I am? Like, I'm right next to you. But I think sometimes we're just not God aware enough. And so I just want to encourage everybody to just be aware of God. You may not feel like God is close, but he's closer than you think. And he's actually doing things without us even being aware. That's how much he loves you.
So you're driving to work right now, getting ready. Okay. Good reminder, isn't it? Just remember how much he loves you, okay? I'll take a short break. If you want to hear all of Peter's interview, you go to myfaithradio.com, and Truth Success will give you to Peter Haas, Pastor Peter Haas. I've got Dr. Cal Beisner on the line. We're going to start talking about the Paris Climate Change Agreement that President is considering pulling out of. He's going to announce today in the White House Rose Room at 3 p.m. Eastern. So we're waiting for that today. Be back in a minute.
My question is this. Is the church of today prepared to stand firm in troubled times? This is Jim Garlow. We have much in common with the early church. Having survived persecution from external attacks, they weren't prepared for what took place next, when the attack suddenly became internal. Sound familiar? The Bible has not only been removed from elementary and secondary education, but stripped from undergrad and graduate level learning in universities and colleges. Some of America's most prestigious universities were founded as Christian institutions, namely Harvard and Yale. And unfortunately, even many contemporary Christian colleges have now been unhitched from the Christian denominations which founded them. The battle for the education of our children has eternal consequences. To paraphrase Mark 8:36, what good is it if all the money in the world were applied to education of our children, if in so doing they lose their very soul? Stay informed at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. It's almost 20 minutes till the top of the hour. Keep moving. Remember to just keep moving. Remember, God loves you. And then in the meantime, we're going to talk about this idea that we're pulling out of the Paris Climate Change. The president is going to make that announcement today at 3 o'clock. That's been talk, discussion. It's we're all going to be curious to see what he says. I have on the studio line Dr. Cal Beisner. He's the founder of the Cornwall Alliance, .org. It's a great place to go for information on the stewardship of creation. And Dr. Beisner is a frequent guest, and he is always so wise. And today is a big day, Cal, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. It has been announced that it will be announced at 3 o'clock today, what the president has decided regarding the Paris Climate Agreement. And the rumors are pretty credible that he's going to pull us out of it. There are some big questions as to whether there will be some qualifications to that and exactly how he's going to go about it. There are several different ways that he could do it, more and less effective ways. But on the whole, I'm optimistic because, frankly, the Paris Climate Agreement makes no sense at all. It means bottom line, it means paying about $23.3 to $46.6 trillion for each tenth of a degree Fahrenheit of climate global temperature reduction in the year 2100, at a grand total of three-tenths of a degree of temperature reduction. So that just doesn't seem to me to be a great bargain. And the guy who wrote the book, The Art of the Deal, I think recognizes that.
Mm-hmm. So the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is also thinking that it's something we need to exit. But there are also other people in the administration that think it's pretty important that we stay. And then the left will go absolutely berserk when the president, if he chooses to do this, because it's probably more than protecting the environment on their side. It might be more of a religion of sorts.
Yeah, well, the left goes absolutely berserk anytime somebody doesn't do exactly what it wants done. I mean, that's called tolerance, you know. but yeah, I mean, what the left sees in this is a combination of a very religious attitude toward the earth that basically says it's best left untouched by human hands, plus a particular political philosophy that basically says human beings are best when they are regimented by some overarching government control, and then also the notion that somehow or other the industrialized countries of the West are guilty of raping and pillaging the earth, and they need to be made to pay the price. We're the ones who put some of that so much of that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that's causing this dreadful global warming. Therefore we need to be made to pay for this, and that's what the Paris Climate Agreement is designed to do. Developing countries essentially have no real obligations. But developed countries have huge obligations not only to reduce our CO2 emissions, which requires our reducing our use of the most abundant, affordable, reliable energy sources that we have, which are absolutely indispensable to everything that we produce, but also we're supposed to pay into a so-called green climate fund that would transfer $100 billion a year from the industrialized countries to the developing countries. So, yeah, put all those things together, and the left is having kittens, shall we say.
Cal, this agreement that the President Obama got us into with the Paris Agreement, climate agreement, was done through executive order and not through Senate approval. Is that correct? You know, maybe you can just give our listening audience
Correct that that's how it was done. It's not correct that that's how it should have been done, because, in fact, it has all the earmarks of a treaty. And the vast majority of countries that have signed on to it did so, signing it explicitly as a treaty. They called it a treaty. And those countries that had legislatures, in addition to executives, had their legislatures ratify the agreement after their executive branch had embraced it. So really, President Obama, according to the Constitution, should have presented this to the United States Senate for a vote, and it should only have bound the United States if the Senate voted with a two-thirds majority to ratify it. Well, President Obama refused to do that because he knew perfectly well that it would go down in flames in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. So if President Obama did not get the Senate vote to get into the Paris Climate Agreement, is President Trump getting out of it without Senate vote? Is he essentially doing what President Obama said?
Yeah, he certainly can do that in that that it was purely an executive agreement by President Obama, and that that can be reversed by any next president. Now, there are a number of different ways that Trump can get out of this. One is simply to say, well, because Obama never presented it to the Senate, it doesn't bind us, and so see you later, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Another way is to say, well, because Obama didn't present it to the Senate, it doesn't bind us, but I'm going to present it to the Senate. And then he lets the Senate vote, and it will certainly crash and burn there. Another way for him to do it is to remove the United States from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the underlying treaty body that that birthed the Paris Climate Agreement. And I think that that would be a very good way to do it, in that as long as we remain in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, environmental advocacy groups here in the United States are going to be able to appeal to that treaty obligation as a basis for lawsuits to try to force the administration by means of the courts to do whatever it is these environmental advocacy groups want us to do. So I think the clean break is to say we are leaving the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, and there'd be a couple of good reasons. One is the issue that the UNFCCC was created to address, namely dangerous man-made global warming, has turned out to be a non-issue in that the warming is simply a tiny fraction of what was anticipated and not dangerous. The other is that the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change recognizes the Palestinian state, but U.S. law passed by Congress and signed by the president before Trump actually requires that the U.S. not be a party of and not provide any funding to any U.N. organization that recognizes the Palestinian state.
Hmm. All right, Cal, we need to take a little break. When we come back, we will continue this conversation right where we left off. I'm speaking to Dr. Cal Beisner from the Cornwall Alliance. That's cornwallalliance.org is the website if you want to go visit his pages. And we will be right back after a short break. It's 15 minutes until the top of the hour. Thanks for being with us. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold talking to Dr. Cal Beisner this morning about the Paris Climate Change Agreement that's going to be decided by President Trump at 3 p.m. today. And it looks like he's leaning towards pulling out of the deal. And Cal, right before we went to break, you said that if the president presented the agreement to the Senate, it would crash and burn there. And I'm trying to figure out why.
Because senators, they want to keep getting elected, and they know that the kind of policies that would be required to comply with the Paris Climate Agreement are policies that would drive up electric rates all over the country, that would drive down employment, that would cost the United States hundreds of billions of dollars every year, that could far better be spent on such things as, maybe paying off the national debt so that we can reduce the amount of money that we just simply squander in interest to international bankers and the like. The American people are not going to sit with that once they understand what's going on. And that's what happens when you get a treaty actually submitted to the Senate. You actually start getting some rational discussion of it instead of mere talking points in the media. Back in 1998, when the world was considering the Kyoto Accord, which is also under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Senate passed 98-0 a resolution that it would not embrace the Kyoto Accord if it were presented to it, and that it would not embrace any kind of climate treaty that would harm the U.S. economy. Well, it's absolutely clear that this is what would happen with the Paris Agreement, and although the vote would probably not be 98-0 this time, it would probably be closer to 89-11 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Cal, Christians in particular, they just get smashed like a burger when it comes to having the scientific community say you Christians are nuts because you're not as passionate about climate change as we are. And I just read, too, that Elon Musk, if the president pulls out of this, is going to get off the White House Advisory Council. And I know personally you do not want Elon Musk mad at you.
I couldn't care less if Elon Musk were mad at me, but I do think that he would be a bit upset about our getting out of the Paris Climate Agreement because our being in it forces us to use the kinds of things into which he has invested his money in terms of energy technologies, especially batteries save up power generated by solar and wind solar panels and wind turbines, and electric cars. He will do really well under the Paris Climate Agreement, and he will not do so well if we're not under the Paris Climate Agreement. So it's all about, you know, knowing which side his bread is buttered on for mm-hmm. Elon Musk. I would be perfectly happy if he left the White House Council. The president doesn't need that kind of advisor. He needs advisors who are committed to justice, who are committed to fair play, to a level playing ground among all the various different energy technologies. And that's another part of what President Trump ran on in his campaign, was saying we need to stop having government pick winners and losers in business and let businesses compete with each other on a level playing ground.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important thing. And frankly, this is something on which I don't often do this, but on this issue, I'm going to really urge our listeners to contact the White House and give them their opinions on this. They can do that on the White House comment line, which is 202-456-1111, 202-456-1111. That comment line is open from 9 to 4, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. every day. I believe that's Eastern time, so mm-hmm. the White House is in the Eastern. And they can do that. It's very, very quick. All they need to do is say either I support or I oppose the president's intention to get us out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And, of course, the Cornwall Alliance supports his getting us out of the Paris Climate Agreement because it's an enormous waste of money, and it's most harmful to the poor around the world because it prevents their using the most abundant, affordable, reliable energy sources to lift themselves out of poverty. So that's really the motivation we have for being involved in this.
I mean, the way it affects the poor is quite significant. I would love for you to just remind our listeners again the impact that would have.
Yeah. Well, I think the most concrete way to do it is to tell a little illustration. The average sub-Saharan African woman spends 6 to 8 hours a day doing nothing but gathering wood and dried dung that she uses as her primary fuel to cook her food and to heat her little mud hut. That's an enormous amount of time for a very little bit of benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And the smoke from that causes 2 to 4 million deaths a year, premature deaths a year, mostly among women and young children who are the most exposed to that smoke. But it also causes hundreds of millions of upper respiratory diseases and eye infections that make it more difficult for people to work to lift themselves out of poverty. So that very thing is part of what traps these people in poverty. They desperately need to replace that wood and dry dung with electricity generated from the least expensive, the most reliable, the most abundant sources, which are coal and natural gas. And, you know, frankly, you can live next door to the world's dirtiest coal-fired power plant, and your air will be cleaner than when you're burning wood and dried dung inside your hut to keep warm.
Mm-hmm.
But that will give you electricity that not only cooks your food and keeps your hut warm, but electricity that refrigerates your food and your medicines so that they don't spoil, electricity that runs your factory so that you can be more productive in work, electricity that runs air conditioning and heating, not for a little mud hut, but for a nice big house. Everything that we do requires energy, especially in the form of electricity, and that's absolutely indispensable to any society rising and staying out of poverty. So, frankly, that's been my main motivation in all of this battle. Right from the very beginning, when I first started studying it, I realized, having lived in Calcutta, India, as a little boy, that telling people they've got to do without abundant, affordable, reliable energy in the form of electricity from fossil fuels is essentially telling them, you have to stay poor.
Mm. Wow. So, Cal, we just have a minute or two left, but I'd be curious to ask you, what do you think, as Christians, we should be focusing on regarding the stewardship of our environment?
Well, that's a really excellent question, and I'll preface my answer by saying I treat that at length in a short book that I wrote called What is the Most Important Environmental Task Facing American Christians Today? And that's available through our online shop at cornwallalliance.org. cornwallalliance.org, what is the most important environmental task facing American Christians today? And I guess the shortest way to answer is this. A clean, healthful, beautiful environment is a costly good. And like any other costly good, wealthier people can afford more of it than poorer people. This is why the world's greatest environmental disasters have always occurred in poor areas, and particularly in areas that are not only poor but also have socialist governments that don't respond well to the needs and the desires of their ordinary people. So, surprisingly enough, the best way we can promote a clean, healthful, beautiful environment is to promote economic development for the poor around the world and the lifting out of poverty of even those poor and developed countries. Because, when you get richer, you don't like smog, you don't like poison water and that sort of thing. Not only do you not like them, but you can also afford to do something about them.
Mm-hmm. Cal, it's such a delight to have you on the show. Thank you for coming on and having this conversation. Again, his website is cornwallalliance.org. Is it the Cornwall? It's just cornwallalliance.org. That's it.
And, that's it.
We'll look forward to chatting again, and maybe in a couple of weeks after this all settles, we can have you back on and talk about the fallout from this.
Great, Bill. Thanks a lot.
You bet, Cal. Thanks.
Comment line again.
Have a great day.
202-456-1111.
Awesome. Thank you so much. 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be right back. When we come back, Dr. Mark Muska is going to talk about Pentecost. Be back in a minute. It is almost the top of the hour. It says in Psalm 27, wait for the Lord, be strong and take heart, and wait for the Lord. So hopefully you can wait for hour two of the show. We'll be back in just a minute. And we've got...
Thank you for listening to this conversation from Faith Radio Mornings. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings. Also, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a show.